already a solemn day of remembrance, this Memorial Day is heavy with the extra burden of the COVID-19 pandemic. Loved ones can't mourn or be together the way that they might have a year ago. And throughout this pandemic, the U.S. Armed Forces, whose primary mission is to defend the American people against enemies foreign and domestic, have had to contend with an invisible enemy. Today, we ask, what is the role of the military in a pandemic, and what should it be? I'm Shamita Basu, and that's where we start today on The Takeaway. According to a 2019 Army manual, the mission of the DoD in a pandemic is to preserve U.S. combat capabilities and readiness, and to support U.S. government efforts to save lives, reduce human suffering, and slow the spread of infection. Now, we've seen the flyovers by the Air Force Thunderbirds and Navy Blue Angels to thank the frontline heroes, the deployment of naval hospital ships to California and New York to handle patient spillover from their overburdened hospitals, and the deployment of more than 40,000 National Guard members to help states battle the virus. Well, now those deployments face a hard stop on June 24th, according to the Trump administration. That leaves the Guard members with an 89-day deployment, just one day shy of the 90-day mark that would make them eligible for early retirement and post-9/11 GI Bill benefits. We will assess all of this with two people: William Arkin, an Army veteran, journalist, and author of more than a dozen books on the military, and Jeffrey Korn, professor of law at South Texas College of Law, Houston, and retired Army lieutenant colonel. Hello, William. Hi, Jeffrey. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on.
And thank you also.
And Bill, I'm curious, really, in the event of a pandemic or some kind of large public health crisis, what is the military supposed to do, and what have they been doing right now?
Well, the entire paradigm of emergency response has sort of been turned on its head as a result of coronavirus. The paradigm that we've been operating with really since 9/11 is that a disaster occurs someplace and assistance comes in from the outside. The military mobilizes resources, and they come from the outside to assist in civil government and civil response. Mm-hmm. Of course, with coronavirus, there is no outside. So we've had to turn the entire paradigm of response on its head, not just civil response, but also the military response. So I would say that in coronavirus, that the paradigm for pandemic response has really been just thrown out the window. This war plan, if you will, didn't survive contact with the enemy, as they say.
Mm. And Jeffrey, can you maybe tell us the difference between how the National Guard is supposed to function in a moment like this compared to, say, other branches?
Yeah, I will say out of the gate that I don't completely agree with the paradigm being completely flipped on its head. As a matter of fact, I think in some ways the domestic emergency response paradigm involving the military has been pretty effective to date. And what I mean by that is the expectation that if there's a crisis in the state that challenges the state authority, then the National Guard, which is under the authority of the state governor, unless it's been put into federal service by the president, will be the first military entity that will be called out to assist civil authorities. I think where I agree with Bill is that that paradigm normally functions in a state or regional basis. So, for example, where I live in Houston, during Hurricane Harvey, the governor called out the National Guard, and he could rely on other states to send support from their National Guard to bolster that response. What we have here is a national emergency. This is unprecedented in recent history. So you've got this odd situation where you have state governors calling up their National Guard units, and those units are not necessarily sufficient to meet the crisis. So they then have to go through FEMA to ask FEMA to get federal military forces to help them. And the federal forces have to come through an order through the Department of Defense, which is normally coordinated by FEMA.
I mean, have we seen anything comparable to this in the past? I take your point, Jeffrey, that this is different because it's unfolding in a national way, very differently than sort of state-centered responses. Is there anything comparable in history that we can look at and maybe learn from in terms of military response?
Well, I mean, I think that the closest thing we would have to this would be the immediate aftermath of 9/11, where it was perceived as an attack on the nation, and therefore it was predominantly a homeland defense mission initially. Mm. But generally, I would say no. I think that this is really unique because the emergency is challenging so many states at the same time, and we've seen this in the news. There are incidents in history where a state gets so overwhelmed by a civil disturbance, for example, that they have to go to the federal government and ask for assistance from federal military forces. That's very rare because federal military forces are prohibited by law from participating in law enforcement unless the president invokes a law called the Insurrection Act. The last time that happened was in response to the Los Angeles riots following the Rodney King verdict in 1992. So it's very uncommon for the federal forces to be used to support the state in a law enforcement function. It's much more common for federal forces to provide kind of humanitarian assistance to help mitigate a disaster or an emergency, because in that capacity, they're not enforcing law.
Bill, in Congress, I understand that lawmakers are currently negotiating what the next coronavirus relief package might look like. And I understand that the Pentagon has requested funds. Does it look like we will be increasing our military spending during this pandemic?
You know, it's really difficult to discuss the military on Memorial Day and be critical. There's some danger involved, both in sounding unpatriotic and disrespectful of those who do serve. But we should look at the facts of what happened here in coronavirus. At no time, despite this national crisis, did the military mobilize more than 62,000 people. And 62,000 sounds like a lot, and in fact, it is a lot. But we should also remind ourselves that on 9/11, in response to those attacks in just Washington and New York, that the National Guard mobilized the same number of people. In fact, on November 28, 2001, the National Guard and Reserve mobilization peaked at 57,000, almost exactly the same as the peak during coronavirus. Mm. Now, why do I say all of this? Because it's important for us to recognize that the military is an augmenting institution. It's not the primary responder, and it shouldn't be the primary responder. That one of the reasons why the military is limited in what it can do and how much it can mobilize is that it's not configured for civil response. These are mostly 18-year-olds with guns and people who have the mission of defending the country and fighting the nation's wars. Mm-hmm. And so rather than looking to the military and saying kind of blindly that they did a great job in coronavirus and we should give them more money, I think it's really more of a lesson of how we need to build up our civil health and public health capacities, that there's only so much that the military can contribute.
So let's talk about one aspect there of healthcare capacity. And maybe, Jeffrey, you can speak to this. There was some controversy over the naval ships that docked in California and New York to handle patient overflow from hospitals. Some people pointed out that it didn't seem like those ships really handled as many COVID patients as they should have. Tell us what you know about that.
Yeah, first off, I couldn't agree more with Bill that there's a general public, I guess, misunderstanding of what the military is. When this began, I heard mayors and governors saying, get the military in here, get the military in here. Mm-hmm. I mean, an armored division or a mechanized infantry battalion is not going to do much to help you when you're trying to provide medical care. And the military doesn't have an endless supply of indigenous medical capability. What they have is the ability to deploy medical resources very quickly and get them set up very quickly, but they are very carefully tailored to the needs of the force, meaning, you know, if there's a combat support hospital, like, you know, the TV show MASH, there's a mobile combat support hospital. That hospital is designated to provide medical support to the troops in the field during a war. And when the hospital ships were sent to New York and Los Angeles, course, I think people have to recognize that for Pentagon planners, the world is a very unpredictable place. And we don't know what's coming down the road a week from now or 2 weeks from now. We've learned this through history. And those ships might necessarily have to be diverted very quickly to support the combat forces they're principally tasked to provide medical care to. So my reaction when I saw that the hospital ship in New York was not taking COVID patients, that it was being used for non-COVID treatment to free up resources in the civilian hospitals for COVID,
right,
was not that that was a failure. To me, that was logical, because the last thing that DOD could accept would be the idea that as suddenly an emergency arose somewhere, the ship had to deploy to provide medical support, and half of the ship's crew had been exposed to coronavirus. So it's a very difficult balance for DOD to make when they commit their resources in support of civil authority, because they have actual national security missions that they always have to be prepared to execute.
And Jeffrey, what do you think we can learn from the way that the military has been deployed in this moment and the way that the military is acting within its own ranks?
Well, I think one of the lessons that's going to come out of this, and one of the points of inquiry, is how prepared the nation is for a real national emergency, and what is the right balance between at the federal response level between the use of military assets and non-military assets. I actually think there are a lot of unanswered questions about the impact of this event on readiness, the inability to engage in training, the inability to move people around, the inability to engage in coalition training and operations, I think is going to have a negative effect on readiness. But I also think there's another interesting aspect of this, and that is that there are times when a response like this requires the ability of leadership to order certain measures that have to be complied with.
Jeffrey Korn is professor of law at South Texas College of Law, Houston, and retired Army Lieutenant Colonel. And William Arkin is an Army veteran, a journalist, and author of more than a dozen books on the military. Thank you both very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Samita.
Thank you.
Who are you remembering on this Memorial Day?
Susan from Washington State. I am remembering a Vietnam veteran, a man I was engaged to as an 18-year-old girl. I broke up with him when he deployed to what I thought would be an easy tour for him in Turkey, but I just recently learned he did go to Vietnam, and I'm so sorry to know how he suffered and how it impacted the rest of his life. So he is on my mind this Memorial Day.
Hey, I'm calling from Morristown, New Jersey. My name is Mercedes. My grandfather fought in World War II in Germany. I'm really proud of his contribution as a Puerto Rican man of color, especially in light of today's political narrative. Thank you.
My name is Kenneth, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I will be remembering my dad, who lived from 1925 to 2015. He served in the North Atlantic, the Mediterranean, the South Pacific, and China. I gave him a thank you card every November for the last 20 years of his life.
Hi, this is BJ Anderson from Scio, Oregon. My grandfather was a veteran of World War I, and my dad was a veteran of World War II. My wife and I will be tending our memorial garden that we planted to honor all of our loved ones. In normal years, we'd have a couple hundred people gathering at our farm. This year, it will be just the two of us, reflecting on how the global challenge that we're all fighting today is not a war, and on how we don't have a president inspiring and unifying the country with America proudly joining forces against a global threat as it did in those two world wars.